Oh, I'm afraid to touch it because the last time it kind of went crazy. Oh, okay. Good? All right. In an article titled A Brief Map of My Redemption, Carrie Beth Neville writes, "We are cartographers plotting our way through past routes and future wanderings, writing our own story into being." As someone who writes both fiction and nonfiction, this writing of a story is more literal for Carrie than for most. And while many metaphorical cartographers would prefer to take an eraser to their past when it involves such topics as recovery or mental health, she sets her story down in ink. What stood out to me most about Carrie's award-winning blog, Mama May Be Mad, was her posts about her children, of course, specifically her desire to protect them from heartbreak. Carrie sees her fiction as a kind of escape from reality at times, though in a way, many of her stories in her Chandra Prize-winning collection, Necessary Lies, actually reflect the same fears that come with love and family, especially with being a mother, that she expresses in her blog posts. At times, these layers of motherhood intertwine, such as Annie in the short story Eggs, who plays the role of responsible older sister, caretaker to many plants, and hopeful mother struggling with infertility. Or Gina in Vigil, who struggles with how to cope with a newly divorced and distracted mother while also mothering her older sister, who keeps both a mental and physical distance from Gina. Even in stories like Remains, in which the main character's mother is dead, 13-year-old Kathleen's loss affects every word that she exchanges with her father. Along with the sadness that comes with these relationships, however, comes great joys, either between Neville's struggling characters or, even more poignantly, I think, between these characters and themselves. In a way, they are the same cartographers learning how to write their own stories, discovering who they are, both with and without the people that they care about the most. When Issa in Renter's Guide to the Hamptons has moved, temporarily, to a less than desirable summer home that holds charms that her husband, who spends most of his time in New York City, can't seem to see, she thinks to herself, "I was happy with the thought that it didn't take much to make me happy." As I finished Necessary Lies, I couldn't stop thinking back to something Carrie Beth Neville describes in her blog post, Open Heart Living. She writes, "This is why I live my heart as openly as possible now, risking vulnerability for joy and grace and connection, understanding that most of the time, or at least in equal time, the return will likely be pain and humiliation and rejection. But that is acceptable, necessary risk, because when it pays off, transcendence." Carrie Beth Neville's fiction and nonfiction have won several prizes, including Short Story Book of the Year from Independent Publisher Magazine. Her work has also appeared in such journals as the Gettysburg Review, Glimmer Train, and Tri-Quarterly. She also writes a regular blog for Huffington Post. Her newest book, Remember to Forget Me, will be published by Braddock Avenue Books this October, although we have copies here, so you should definitely get one. Carrie earned degrees from Colgate University and the writing program at the University of Houston, and she is now an assistant professor of creative writing at Georgia College and State University. Please join me in welcoming Carrie Beth Neville to the stage.
It really is the posy to cover the stench of decay. Aggressive in my face. Thank you all for having me here. Thank you, Aaron and Keith, for the invitation. And thank you to Florida State for sponsoring this. It was a lovely drive down here through cotton fields, which are beautiful but also haunted. You can't help but look at some of the landscape without remembering history. And I'm going to be reading a story from my new book that is, I guess, historical fiction. It's based on a real person called the Lion Man, who was in the freak show at Coney Island at the turn of the last century. And the idea for the story came because the real world is always informing my fiction, and my imagination is always informing my nonfiction, so it's a kind of blurry boundary for me. But I was sitting in the car listening to NPR, waiting for my kids to come out of school, and this story came on about the man who invented baby incubators in the late 19th century. And he tried to sell them to hospitals because most premature infants died at the time. And the hospitals just kind of, you know, poo-pooed him, like didn't believe they were going to work. And so he wound up selling them, installing them at the freak show at Coney Island. And I'm sitting in the car listening to them. If you're a writer, you're like, oh my God, this is gold. I've got to use this somehow. And so people would bring their premature infants there, and the babies would stay in these incubators for several months until they could go home, and people would pay money to walk by the babies because they were kind of these freaks because they were surviving when they should have died. And then when I started doing research into this doctor and the incubators, I discovered the Lion Man, who you'll hear in this story. The book has an epigraph. Most of these stories, it's funny, my first book, my only other first book, feels very different to me. And obviously, I wrote it when I was younger. This book is mostly concerned with questions of exile and memory, personal kind of themes for me in my journey. You know, as Kelly explained, I write a lot about recovery. And when you look back to try to piece together a life and understand how you arrive at this place of kind of decimation, really, but then how you pull yourself out of it with help from a lot of people, with help from a lot of drugs, with help even, I had an exorcism. They really thought I was, you know, that far gone. You know, you try to piece together identity from the end bits that remain. And so that's really the spirit that informs this book. But it's not as serious as that sounds. So the epigraph is from the poet Mahmoud Darwish, Palestinian poet, and it comes from his poem, A Lover from Palestine. Take me as a relic from the mansion of sorrow. Take me as a verse from my tragedy. Take me as a toy, a brick from the house, so that our children will remember to return. The Lion Man. In the evening, dreamland hummed under 1 million incandescent bulbs strung across its streets like tethered stars. Tens of thousands arrived by steamship from terminals in Manhattan and Harlem, jammed the promenades and exhibition halls, and jostled each other to see the corralled wild men of Borneo chanting their strange guttural songs, or Zip, the what-is-it pinhead, plucking haplessly at his banjo and hopping from foot to foot, or the Lilliputia dwarves in their scale model town of 15th century Nuremberg, with its own parliament, fire engines responding hourly to false alarms, and a Chinese laundryman washing, ironing, and folding small clothes into fastidious warm stacks. 2-hour lines for the airships, the ocean wave, and the giant racer. And they came to see him, the Lion Man, tamed king of beasts, reclining on a pile of turkey carpets. The brave and entitled demanded locks of his long, coarse mane, as if they were talismans or trophies. He'd seen photos of rich men leaning on long rifles beside lion, rhino, and elephant carcasses, had been chased by poor men holding rocks, shouting epithets. A clipping seemed a small price for his ease of mind. He backflipped 3 or 4 times in a row across the stage for a fist of coins, more for the pleasure and rush of movement, even though his knees and shoulders ached after a lifetime of acrobatics. One day, he'd miss and break his leg or crack his skull. Who would pay to see him then, hobbling on crutches, head wrapped like a mummy? When the park emptied of the teeming crowds and fell quiet except for the odd roadster trundling down Surf Avenue, or the muted trumpets of Little Hip the elephant, or the pickled laughter of other freaks staggering by as much as it was possible to stagger with no legs or four. The Lion Man stood at the window of the baby incubators, a mock farmhouse with timber beams and a gabled roof, better suited for Yorkshire than Brooklyn. Anchored at the peak, a stone stork hovered over a nest of cherubs, its beak pointed as if at a trough of herring. Inside the building, there were a row of premature infants in the incubators, boys pinned with blue ribbons, girls with pink. The heated boxes more peanut roasters than scientific wonders. Sometimes a nurse, the hefty one, eased an infant's arm from the swaddling and slipped her diamond ring over the tiny fingers, then hand, making an impromptu Tiffany bangle. Women tugged off their own rings, held them between their fingers, estimating the impossible measurement. He pressed against the baby incubator's window, hair tickling his face like a woman's lips might, though this was an approximate feeling, as even prostitutes, granting a fuck, refused such intimacies. They did allow him, for 50 cents, to palm their pocked cheeks and trace the fine down from their temples to jaws. Afterward, he stood at the sink, washing the tacky residue of face paint from his hands, and stared into the dim, spidered mirror, trying to see past his given lot. Dark eyes visible, the planes of his face? A self obscured beneath hair, fur, coat, pelt? Time moving forward and through him, evidenced by the occasional silver strands plucked from his forehead and chin, but otherwise the same. He could only, always, look away. Years before, the Lion Man traveled in Baron von Hausmann's circus across the continent. The Baron was a tall, rickety man, his imperial mustache an autocratic punctuation. He locked the Lion Man inside a small, rusty cage, once home to a screeching monkey that served tea to a filthy doll. It died after drinking from a bucket of green paint. The Lion Man, still a boy, was ordered to leap and growl at the bars, at little girls in particular, though they often giggled at his exaggerated, high-pitched ferocity. By evening, invariably tired and hungry, he slumped to the ground. The Baron whacked the bars with his cane, jabbing his ribs, startling him awake. Once, he woke to a woman's gloved finger stroking the long hair on his cheek. An exquisite tenderness filled with pity and yearning. He shivered, mesmerized in sensation. She perched beside his cage, her black taffeta skirt collapsed around her in gleaming folds. Crow waiting clear-eyed on the tip of a branch, a toque cantilevered on top of a loose coil of hair. He held her steady blue eyes with his, waiting for her scream, for the chicken bone thrown from her pocket. This was what people did, shouted and threw scraps of food. In the countryside, anyway, when the tents were set up in muddy fields ripe with horse shit. In the city, less food and more coins were tossed through the bars. The woman was close, her shallow inhalations and exhalations audible, and then so quick it might never have happened at all, her face was against the rusty bars, her fingertips beneath his chin, and lips were on his. "Mein Liebeskind," she said, a whispered, sorrowful secret. An iron flake, a rusty petal, stuck to her creamy cheek. He imagined her whole face in bloom, tipped to the sun. Reach through the bars and brush it away? Disastrous. The Baron had beaten him for less. Her hand rustled in her dress and reappeared, bills pinched between her fingers. She flicked them angrily, and they scattered on the straw-covered ground. Had the strange yoking of sympathy and desire cost her too much? She rose, her back dismissing him. No matter, he had her money. Paper easier to hide than coins in the slit seam of his thin mattress. He lurched and snarled as she disappeared into the crowd. The incubator infants were swaddled in white blankets, wrapped tight against the shadows. So small and their need so great. Weeks and weeks early for this world. No defenses except the metal and glass boxes, what a magician might escape from in seconds. And Dr. Cooney with his charts, droppers, and needles, and the wet nurses whisking them to the nutrition parlor in the back. Warm air regulated by a thermostat pumped through pipes across the bottoms of the incubators. Nothing more, really, than heated water chambers at a chick hatchery. The narrow mattresses rested on scales monitoring weight to the tenth of a gram. 970 grams, 1,120 grams, 1,460 grams. Large black numbers on cards attached to the boxes. Twice a day, the nurses switched the cards out, their faces flat and impassive as they took the readings. Spectators sneezed into grubby handkerchiefs, breathed their germy breath, and reached over the railing, leaving greasy fingerprints on the incubator's windows. The nurses, in their spotless white dresses and peaked caps, strode through with rags and Lysol bottles, rubbed at the glass in brisk, determined circles, then shooed back the crowds to wipe the railings. The Lion Man noted all this during his breaks each day, and at night, when he was free to walk unmolested. He watched the nurse, the one with the soft eyes and hair that shimmered yellow like the fields in Bavaria. The sun there had fallen in benediction across wheat as it spread out from the train tracks. His head had bumped a rhythm against the compartment's window. He imagined vaulting from the train like the Indian acrobats from their ladders. His mane, which he combed for fleas, lice, and chaff, disheveled from the flight and tumble. If he kept his bare palms and soles to the ground, he could disappear into all that rolling light. Hildegard. Violetta, the half-woman, told him her name. Dr. Cooney called his daughter Hildy, and the two promenaded around the park in the evening like mismatched sweethearts. The doctor was always impeccable in dark broadcloth, spats, and a derby. He stooped, though, leaning on a crooked cane, and grasped his daughter's arm as they walked past the exhibits lingering at the entrances. He talked, gestured, and talked, more, perhaps agitated by the day's events in the nursery. She listened, nodded, and steered him through the crowd. In contrast to her father, Hildegard stood tall, her shoulders thrust back in youthful assurance and enthusiasm. It must have required great restraint to keep to her father's measured pace. On her solitary walks, her feet moved quickly beneath her skirts and her arms switched back and forth, a purely constitutional outing. The Lion Man had been lying beside Violetta, a usual consideration to mitigate the distance between them since, like half a dress form, she had no arms or legs. Of course, using her teeth, she sewed her armless dresses, lit cigarettes, and sketched spectators. And sang, not especially well, but with bravado, what it took when you looked like them. Sea shanties she learned from Ajax the Sword Swallower, the Saucy Sailor Boy, Whiskey Johnny, and New York Girls. He propped his head with his hand. The kinky waves of his mane brushed the ground. He was still in costume, red ottoman vest embroidered with gold flowers, blue silk sash knotted at the waist, and black pantaloons. "You're like a pasha," Violetta said, nudging him with her hip, a side shuffle she'd perfected. "You need a harem of those ticket girls." Those girls wore blue academic robes and mortar boards and stood in their booths selling wheels of tickets each day. At night, as the lights flickered out across the park, the girls gathered at the entrance beside the massive gold columns, then left in tight clusters for the train, glancing warily at the freaks, ending their own long days in raucous, liquored companionship. He smiled, lips closing over his nine teeth, all he had ever had. Violetta puffed her cigarette. "Imagine fucking one of them. And that girl, Cooney's daughter, you know, she was one of us in one of those incubators, a regular miracle." She spat the end of her cigarette to the ground where it glowed, then winked out. "We all are," he said, "surviving them." Them, the unmaimed who gawked and jeered, grabbed and punched and worse. When Violetta was a girl, A drunk carried her under his arm to an alley where he had his way, then left her with the garbage and rats. And her torn undergarments thrown, she joked, just out of reach. Violetta recounted this one night as they talked of their time in the Chicago exhibition, where the Lion Man had held her on his lap on the Ferris wheel, the world's first, as it rose up and down, carrying 2,000 people above the dazzling white buildings, high enough to see the endless lake and the distant city stretch out before them. They boasted of the indignities they'd suffered, trading pain like the coin of the realm. Worse to be a Lion Man or a Seal Man? 9 feet or 18 inches? Siamese twin or no limbs? In the late afternoons, Hildegard stood in the building's shade, drinking a glass of water in long, generous sips, throat moving with each swallow. She untied her apron, lifted it over her head, and shook it 3 times. The fabric crackled in the air. She took off her cap, holding the pins between her lips, and her hair tumbled down her back in a glossy wave. She gathered it to one side, wiped her hand across her neck, and in one easy motion, twisted her hair and tucked it away. Once a freak. He tongued the gaps in his mouth, part of his ailment, what the physicians in Gdansk, Rome, and Manhattan called olesiene nadmirne, polytrichosi, hypertrichosis. The words meant nothing since there was no cure. Skeins of hair and teeth in ruins. Except for mercenary interests, none of them came near him. During his passage on the Hamburg American, he remained for all 6 days in his steerage cabin, eating the bruised apples, stale bread, and hard-boiled eggs he had wrapped in a wool scarf. His cabin mate refused to share the room, and so he was alone, passing the hours in anxious sleep, or rereading a copy of Scientific American he'd found on a trolley in the hall, a new spindle for spinning wool, a turbine water wheel, a bull with 2 mouths. Men knocked on his door, jiggled the knob, shouted for him to show his face, but he stayed out of sight behind the lock, the only guarantee some drunk, who once he saw his face, wouldn't toss him overboard. In the deep hours of night, he staggered down the passageway to use the toilet, the ship pitching and rolling, slamming him against walls. During the day, he pissed and heaved into the refuse bin. One morning, before the park opened, he and Mortado, the human fountain, watched Captain Jack work Black Prince, the lion, in the arena. The trainer and lion were in a cage bigger than his own in the Baron's circus, big enough for the animal to run when prodded by the whip, in a wide circle, its muscles rippling beneath its sandy coat. Captain Jack fed it meat from a bucket outside the bars. He wiped the blood from his hands on a towel, then rubbed the lion's neck, his fingers disappearing into the shaggy black mane. The lion's attention never wavered. It sat up on hind legs over and over, without protest or antagonism, the repetition erasing instinct. But then it had never raced across the savannah pursuing an antelope or slept in the dust in the blasted heat, tasseled tail twitching at flies. Instead, it only knew cages and rail cars and wheelbarrows of bones and butchered horse meat. "If there was anything else you could do," Mortado asked. He poked the corks from the holes bored through his palms and feet, and began cleaning the wounds, a meticulous daily necessity to keep infection at bay. For his act, copper tubes snaked through the holes and spurted water at the audience. On Saturdays, he reenacted the crucifixion, stuffing pouches of red fluid in the holes. An assistant dressed as a soldier of the Roman Legion drove in the nails. One of the most successful acts. People fainted. "What would I be?" the Lion Man asked. "A dentist." And not because in that life he might have most of his teeth, but because people would tremble at him for this reason alone, and it would be in his power to soothe them in Polish, Russian, German, or English, any of the languages he knew. He would have the words to quiet their fear, the skills to help them, and the tools to see it through. Picks, pliers, morphine. Diest weird nicht weten. This won't hurt. When he sat on his pile of Turkey carpets, he spoke to the crowd softly to bring them close, but they couldn't hear him for his fearsome strangeness. Ich werde dich nicht weiten. I won't hurt you. I wouldn't choose this life, the lion man said, but you do this yourself. You do this to yourself. The money isn't that good. Mortado shrugged, poured water in his palm. It splashed through to the ground. He said, even if it's a con, I'm astonishing. People come to see me. If I was a bookkeeper, a shoeshiner, a delivery man, every week I survive what Jesus Christ himself could not. The lion man did not think of himself as astonishing, an overgrown curiosity, occasionally terrifying the very young, but he had no fangs, was nothing to run away from. Like Black Prince, cowed by the whip and chair, by the captain, a man of ordinary size and strength. But then, last week, the lion swiped the captain's hand with its claw, hooking tendon and bone. Despite amputation, Captain Jack died from infection. Black Prince, freed from the tricks, now circled its pen without purpose or audience. The lion man walked by the cage before his own performance one morning. The lion paced the bars, pausing before changing direction. Time enough to imagine something else, some inherited idea of open sky and space. Could he slip his hand through the bars and stroke its neck, the sinew and muscle tightening beneath him? Contact the lion must long for, or certainly miss, or at least register its absence. But he wasn't kin, and the lion would just as surely spear his hand or neck. You're here again. Hildegard stood under the lamp, a beetle thumping against the bulb. A statement, not a question. He was an obvious presence, usually surrounded by children pointing and shrieking and tugging at his mane. The reason for coming at night. Dreamland is dreamland, he said. Gondolas float under the Rialto, past the Doge's palace, and Pompeii forever erupts. The city and its people always buried under ash. History is tedious, he said, one thing after another without change. She laughed, but her eyes remained cool and level, appraising him. The nurses are afraid of you. It's silly, but they insist the infant's hearts quicken when you're near. They're the true Lilliputians, he said. Only the infants grow and their parents return and they leave. Easy happiness and all that possibility. He stepped closer. She smelled clean, the tar of carbolic soap in comparison to his musk. At times, his animal self was undeniable. The day had been hot and the air under the red velvet curtains heavy and stagnant. His underarms and crotch were spongy and slick with sweat. Some die, she said. Parents leave with another box, which they bury in the ground. Most of the visitors who scrap together 10 cents are mothers, or were. Their longing is terrible. They fall to the ground, climb over the railings, get tangled up in their skirts, and are hauled off by guards. They're wanted, he said, smiling, lips tight against the jumble in his mouth. He didn't say this to gain easy sympathy, merely to state what it meant to earn a living from disease, misfortune, or deliberate mutilation. And to acknowledge his own desire, what held him to the window night after night. As Violetta said, the premature infants were freaks, the incubator building on their side of the park, but they would become more than their beginning condition. No seal fins, no scales, and unlike Princess Wee Wee, taller than 24 inches. I'm Hildegard, she said, and held out her hand. He took his time reaching out, extending the moment. So few physical intimacies, and always a shock. He'd been denied a routine erotic life, substituting small sensual pleasures. An apple peel unwinding between his thumb and pocket knife. A comb pulling down his neck, then chest and arms, the teeth surprising and sharp on his bare palms. Cold water rising up his shins, lapping his thighs as he waded into the surf. Hildegard's hand was sturdy and rough, all that scrubbing, and her fingers tightened around his without hesitation or feminine deference. He wanted to kiss her hand in gallant daring, but feared she would tug away, offended. "I'm the Lion Man." "Yes," she said, "but your name?" Ordinary, which made it ridiculous, as he had never been who he was born to be. Stefan. Stefan Bebrowski. A name rarely used, except to sign for wages. "Stefan, come with me." She turned and walked into the building. Her skirts whirled around her ankles. The other nurse, Rausch, resisted. She stood in the aisle, ready to push them back. The room was lit only by dim sconces and quiet, no crowds, just the infants asleep, a kind of hibernation in their dens, dreaming of nothing. Because what have they experienced from which dreams could expand and shift and terrify and delight? What alternative could their dreams offer? The Lion Man woke from his own dreams, panicked, heart racing, gulping for air, wondering where he was, even though, of course, he was in his rented room with the creaky bed springs and the chipped green bowl and pitcher. Even so, he felt heckled and pursued in dreams rather than freed from his life. "No," Nurse Rausch said, "against protocol." Everything about her was efficient and disciplined. Dark hair pulled into a solid bun. Oxfords gleamed with polish, eyes fixed on Hildegard, refusing to see him. Hildegard shrugged. "My father will fire me?" The woman took a wider stance. "He will infect them with disease." The Lion Man turned over his hands, and while they couldn't see his clean palms, they could see they were smooth. Hildegard bumped past her. "He can wash in the back." At the sink, she turned on the faucet and gave him the cake of red soap. "Scrub hard," she said, scissoring palms in demonstration. The hair on the backs of his hands lathered into wet, stringy clumps like seaweed along a shore. He rinsed and shook off the water. "Here, hold them out." Hildegard folded a white towel around his hands and rubbed, as if drying a boy's sopping head. Difficult to hold steady. She dropped the towel into a bin, then poured a capful of antiseptic into his hands. "Now rub again," she said without sentiment. And then a grin. "Safeguard," she said, "no lice." Her teeth were crooked on the bottom, a charming imperfection. He didn't remember much of his own mother. She had sold him to the Baron when he was 5. Mostly, he recalled her screaming through his bedroom door that he was an abomination. Her voice strained, then splitting apart into tears. He would put his eye to the keyhole, blue fabric covered in white polka dots, a wedge of pink knuckle, then her dark eye pinned to his. She was quiet. He held his breath and imagined his mother might finally see him, see into him, without the distraction of his offending body. She could hold him like this in her gaze. He asked for nothing more. But then he blinked, and she was gone, clunking back down the stairs in her brown boots that were tied with lengths of butcher's string knotted together. What she told the doctor she consulted. When she was pregnant, his father was mauled to death by the mangy lion at the city zoo. She was there, had seen it happen. The stupid man, she said, had dropped his gold pocket watch, a gift from a rich uncle when he entered university, into the walled pit. The lion, asleep at the back, indolent from the heat, was at first unaware of her husband's descent down the access ladder, despite the large sign that said, "Keep out," but then it charged one heavy paw to the neck and her husband was dead. When Stefan was born 2 months later, slick and covered with hair, she knew her infant was cursed and refused to hold him to her breast. Even the wet nurse was paid double. "Better you should have shriveled up," she hissed at him in later years when he pleaded hunger or thirst. His mother made attempts, shaving him each day, sometimes twice a day. But how could she bring him outside, covered in all those scabby nicks? She had an unsteady hand since she'd taken to brandy. Besides, neighbors and shopkeepers were afraid, whispered that he was a werewolf. Better to lock him in his bedroom, change out the slop bucket, and go on with her life. Once a week, she brought him to the kitchen to stand in a tub of icy water. The gas lamp hissing in the corner, and though it sounded malevolent, the lamp cast his haggard mother in a warm glow. So that while she was scouring him with the rough sponge, he understood that this might be as close to love as he would ever get. Hildegard draped a sheet across him at the insistent suggestion of Nurse Rausch, who stood by the door, unforgiving in her disapproval. Even in the half-light, the immense diamond sparkled on her stout finger, neither a utilitarian nor straightforward ornament, yet proof of extravagant desire. She caught his glance, slipped off the ring, and put it in her pocket. "Paste," she said. "Fake. Part of the show. The doctor's idea to use it for demonstration on the infants." Hildegard opened an incubator's door. Warm, humid air drifted out, boggy like moss, but talcum powder, too. A pink ribbon was pinned over the baby's cap. Hildegard stroked the satin strip. "Her heart isn't much bigger than your thumbnail," she said, "but it's enough." He looked down at his uneven nails and ragged cuticles, the white half-moons hidden by a fringe of hair. Surely Rausch was correct in her assessment. The child should be left in its warming pan, undisturbed, untroubled. But Hildegard was already lifting her out of the incubator and into his arms, a potential world of harm. He'd never held an infant, a puppy, a kitten, even a tiger cub once, whose razor claws raked through his own 10 inches of fur, then skin, hair drying in a bloody clump. The child weighed less than his curled leather slippers, but still so easy to drop. Her face was smooth and untroubled, without history. Only a wisp of hair whirled on top of her head. What he longed for was in the infant's face. No suffering, no shame. Was his pain worth it? A bottle of morphine wrapped in a sock in the back corner of a bureau drawer answered to that. An ever-ready alternative. If she lived, the infant would live an ordinary life, a pram, a frilly blanket tucked around her, the autumn sun flashing across her face, the family cat waving its tail just out of reach, a tantrum when it darted off, a schoolyard, a game of tag, a spelling test. Hildegard looked at the chart on the incubator. 4 weeks and still losing weight, she deflated. What should he say? That he would, against reason, knowing nothing about the infant or the parents, of their circumstances, rich or poor, or their composition, generous or mean, give his life for hers? He had always been aware, to the penny, of what his life was worth. He had made peace with longing, knew how much to pay for a fuck, since it never came free from reciprocal desire, knew circumstances might alter exterior space, city, apartment, stage show, but the interior space, solitary, would remain unchanged. He would never be a father. Even a prostitute, if accidentally with his child, would panic and demand a knitting needle. But to claim something, someone, as his own, other than what he could fit inside a steamer trunk or pocket or sock, to be held in place by another's needs, to be what is needed. The infant's body moved with each slight breath. Her heat settled into him. As he studied her small face, he saw, as if rising out of relief, that she had no brows or lashes. Unsettling. And her red skin, mapped with blue veins, was covered in fuzz. "This hair," he said, and couldn't finish. Was this how he had presented to the world? "Most are covered in it," Hildegard said. She reached over and touched the baby's forehead, riffling the tiny hairs. "In a few weeks, it will fall out, and then nothing between her and the world." "Maybe with all this hair, I'm too early," he said. She laughed. "The incubators are effective, but not enough." "You can get used to anything," he said, and in an imperceptible but brutal movement, shifted the infant away from him. A careful cradle without connection, like holding a stunned fish or balancing a tray of champagne flutes. He wondered at the size of his own heart, a tight fist, and under what circumstances it might open. Hildegard fiddled with a button on her cuff, pushing it in and out of the buttonhole. "You could come here when I'm here at night. You could help," she said. Night after night, expectation and fulfillment. Such an arrangement would never last. Hildegard buttoned her cuff and busied herself with temperatures and weights and diapers. On the infant's chart, a name, Martha Lloyd. Her eyes blinked open, and she seemed to look up at him, and he looked down at her and wondered, "Who will you be if you live, Martha Lloyd?" Likely, the infant only saw an indiscriminate shadow. A startling, discordant clanging. The fire alarm. All the park's fire alarms. The lion man clutched the infant to him, instinct perhaps, though he would have held a dog just the same. Both nurses rushed to the windows. Outside, beyond Lilliputia, Hell Gate was on fire. Flames already engulfed the roof and the enormous winged demon that hunched over the eaves. Sparks, lifted by the updraft, landed around baby incubators like cannon fire. The building would burn and they would die if they stayed. Hildegard and Nurse Rausch shouted at him as they unlatched the incubators. He could, with certainty, hold four. Their walk across Dreamland for Luna Park was a mostly silent, grim procession. The world was on fire. Orange flames and billowing dark smoke consumed the baby incubators, the power plant, the White Tower, Shoot the Chutes, and the destruction of Babylon. Steam engines and hook and ladders, already too late, sounded a continual alarm. Firemen fought with leather hoses that pulsed sporadic water from failing pumps. Hell's Gate and all 50 acres of buildings, constructed of lath and staff, like plaster of Paris models, collapsed. Light bulbs popped overhead, raining slivers of glass. Shells exploded in the shooting gallery as if war had commenced. In the arena, animals growled and screeched. Hildegard held two infants in one arm. With her free hand, she flicked cinders off her dress. The lion man ignored the welts on his body and singed hair. It would grow back. It always did. Otherwise, he would have bathed in flames long ago. He carried two infants in each arm. Hildegard and Nurse Rausch each held three cradled in their aprons, the way children might gather up wild berries in their shirts. They stopped often, rearranging the blankets over the infants' faces and feeling for their breath. He might as well have been checking the life signs of sparrows, but yes, he said, I feel them all. And then, Violetta. Did someone carry her out, or was she waiting, like the last bowling pin in the lane? Surely she had been sitting with the rest in the hall, cards in hand, bets and whiskey on the table, laughing over idiots who asked whether they had cock traps and bum balls, hearts and brains, whether they were humans at all. How close to hold the infants, how quickly but carefully to step. The parents, oblivious, asleep in their beds in Manhattan or Astoria or Flushing, curtains pulled, empty crib assembled in such great sad hope. If he tripped, under his weight, the infants would smash like eggs. Hildegard was sure-footed despite her skirts. People must think you stole off with dinner, she said. No one looked twice. When they reached the baby incubators at Luna Park, nurses, without thanks or a second look, took the infants from him and threw the sooty blankets in the trash bin. He'd only seen the infants bundled up, layer upon layer, heads capped, little Eskimos ready for the fierce, inhospitable cold. But now, lying on the steel examination tables, they resembled newborn rabbits, skin mottled red and purple and covered in fine hair. They mewled when the nurses trickled water over their bodies, washed them with their fingertips, and rubbed them dry. Hildegard was busy. Her father had arrived, and she dashed about under his orders, forgetting the lion man, as it should be. He never assumed Hildegard held anything but kind, circumstantial regard for him as a fixture of Dreamland, a curiosity. But he stood outside and watched the flames bleed into the dark sky, and Hildegard scribbling on charts, and the infants who would leave one day for those empty cribs, or would not, but who would never remember any of this? Not Dreamland, not Dr. Cooney, or Hildegard, not the lion who held them. He listened to stories from Dreamland's wandering survivors about how the bear cub, the one that rode the bicycle, was found on Surf Avenue, the tips of its ears melted and eyes swollen shut. about how the animals in the arena had been loose, the trainers herding them in a procession to wait out the chaos of the fire. But the lights went out, and the panicked animals turned on each other as the walls collapsed. About how Black Prince charged from the arena, mane a burning halo. Police shot him in the train tunnels. An officer split his skull with an axe. Onlookers fought over souvenirs, chopped the tail, hacked the mane, broke off teeth. He waited, just as he had waited at his bedroom door for his mother to stagger up the stairs, his eye to the keyhole, plucking hair after hair from his body in hopes that she might stay. And when he tired of waiting, while watching Dreamland's end, he might understand his own. Ordinary. An apartment in Berlin on the top floor so the curtains could stay open and the light fall in. The grocery boy would knock with the delivery. Eggs, bread, and apples. But no answer. Day after day. And then the smell. The constable would be summoned. In the bathroom, they would find the tub filled with water, now cold, the soap under the toilet, and the lion man on the floor, but not naked, not with all that silver hair. Thank you. Thank you. Now I feel distinguished. I'm happy to take any questions if anybody has questions. I know that's always like the awkward moment at readings because, you know, you wait for somebody to ask a question and nobody does, and then you feel bad, so you do. And Coney Island. Yes. And the basic facts of that story are all true. You know, that was one of the great pleasures. I love research, and indeed, the lion man did want to be a dentist. Just wonderful, right? You can't make that up. Indeed, Dreamland burned down, you know, in the Great Fire. They did save the babies in those incubators. Not he didn't. I made that part up. And there was Luna Park, which was the adjacent park on Coney Island that had another set of incubators. So all the infants were saved. But yes, the details of the lion being shot in the tunnel was true. Yeah. Violetta, she is true. I don't know the facts of her story, but I went online because when I started with the incubators, and then when I started looking up photographs of the incubators online, I found a photograph of the lion man on a postcard from the time. And then I just started doing research about who was in the freak show with him at the time, and Violetta, in fact, was, and they did have Lilliputia. I mean, it was all set up like that, so yes, she was there. Oh, I will leave that up for you. Are you hopeful or are you a person of despair? I do have to say, when I was revising this book, because a lot of these stories have been published before our present administration came into effect, over the past couple of months, I was, you know, just doing a final pass through, and all of my ends of my stories got darker. I don't know. I couldn't. I don't know. So maybe Violetta, yeah, they left her behind. Thank you.